AUK Jackson, Milwaukee's real news and great conversation. A Civic Media Station.
CBS News Brief. The government shutdown has consequences, not just for Americans who rely on services, but for those people who provide them. CBS's Kelly O'Grady.
They're not going to be getting paid. They would get back pay, but think about if this goes on for a couple of weeks, the ripple effect. They may not be able to pay rent.
Attorney General Pam Bondi says the current federal law enforcement presence in Memphis will help that city be the city locals want it to be.
They want to make Memphis prosperous. They want to bring businesses there. They want to keep it a beautiful city that it is. It's so historical. And yet, the crime is through the roof.
Scientist Jane Goodall has died after living the dream she'd had since childhood.
That's when my dream began. I'll go to Africa, live with animals, write books about them. That was it. No intention of being a scientist because girls didn't do that sort of thing.
Goodall was 91. Her foundation says she died of natural causes while on a speaking tour in California. CBS News Brief, I'm Peter King.
The 540 WAUK Text to Win contest is sponsored by Pickleball Kingdom, just a half mile north of Silver Spring Drive off Pilgrim Road, Menominee Falls.
The Brewers warming up. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports, baseball. The Brewers worked out at AmFam Field as they wait to find out who they'll play Saturday. The Cubs beat the Padres 3-1 in game one of their best of three game wildcard series. Brewers catcher William Contreras had another MRI on his left hand that's bothered him all season, manager Pat Murphy.
You're not going to be able to keep William out no matter what the analysis is of that injury. He's going to play.
NFL, Matt LaFleur on what went wrong in the final minute in overtime that led to the Packers settling for a tie with the Cowboys.
When we're not in two-minute mode and then you jump into two-minute mode, everybody on the field has to know that. And we were operating more of our, you know, no huddle tempo, which isn't warp speed. It's a bad look, quite honestly. And it's just the communication and process have got to be cleaned up because we can't allow that ever to happen again.
That's Matt LaFleur with sports. I'm Mike Clemens.
Get ready to go for the green and gold on 540 WAUK. Listen each weekday for the keywords to text for your chance to win our daily prize. $200 cash and gold jewelry. And be entered to win our grand prize. Two indoor club-level seats to see the green and gold take on Minnesota. Download our free Civic Media app and listen weekdays at 7, 9, 11, 1, 3, 5, and 7 for your chance to win in our multi-state contest. Complete rules at civicmedia.us. Sponsored in part by attorney Michelle Fitzgerald at Horizons Law Group. Getting divorced or need divorce coaching? See horizonslaw.com.
Real news, great conversation from Milwaukee and beyond. 540 WAUK.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. Boy, oh boy. Yesterday we talked about the Quantico speech as it was coming. Not really sure what it was going to be. Not sure what the point was. Oh, what a clown show. And the sad reality is these are the world's top military brass being pulled from all around the world, which leaves us a lot less safe. But honestly, credit where credit is due. Trump's Quantico speech was a masterclass in word salad insanity. Dizzying in its scattershot delivery and the baffling content. The sheer volume of half-baked grievances and self-aggrandizing boasts and reimagined history. I'm sure left no one with their head not hurting. And look, there was no coherent thread to even begin to attack or even follow. So even if I wanted to attack it, I'm like, I don't even know. There was so much. If there was ever a moment to invoke the 25th Amendment, this rambling display should, would, and could be it. From bizarre musings about auto pens and gold paper to a confusing claim about two N-words you can't say while repeatedly shouting nuclear like a mantra, one of the other N-word, so you know. The speech just teetered on the surreal. Then came the really, truly alarming part. Evidently, we're going to use our military to fight the enemy within. Going to target cities like San Francisco, Chicago, New York, Los Angeles. Extremely dangerous they are, he claimed, suggesting that military force would supplant civil authorities. You ready for that? You ready for the Marine Corps to come in and replace your police department? Imagine that traffic stop. It was really a chilling vision of domestic intervention veiled in what I can only say is absolute buffoonery. Trump blamed President Biden for the horror show in Afghanistan and linked it to Putin's invasion of Ukraine, claiming his absence, he would have stopped it. He boasted about nuclear upgrades mixed with hopeful denial. Just more confusion. He waxed poetic about reawakening the warrior spirit, disparaging past military leadership, mocked the Nobel Prize as rigged, boasted of $1 trillion are going to spend on the budget, and then back again to Canada as the 51st state. Really, a massively incoherent volley of threats, nostalgic platitudes, and grandiose delusions meant to leave all of us asking, what in the was that? And did it in front of the top military brass on this planet. I got to tell you, genius in its insanity, because it defies focus and demands disbelief. I could go through every one of the insane comments that Trump made, that Hegseth made. It would just make your head hurt. It was just bad. And I asked the question, when do we as a country go bad? Somebody save us from bad. This is horrible. And look, as I couldn't have even predicted. And look, I've been saying it's going to get worse. I said all during the campaign, it's going to be horrible. And that the solutions for our future will come out of the savagery of their suffering. Not even I had dressed down the military hierarchy on national TV, on global TV, calling them fat, weak, and woke. Yeah. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Going to take a quick break. When we come back, Virginia Berger is going to be here to share some thoughts on how she sees this. Back after this.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, as I get it, and again, the way I took the speech today, so our military leaders are fat, weak, woke, and we're going to reawaken the warrior spirit by using said fat, weak, woke military on our streets to fight the enemy within, as we're on the verge of a government shutdown. I got it. If that was the message, loud and clear. Now, reality is I was never in the military, but this doesn't seem like leadership to me. That's why I've asked Virginia Berger to come share some thoughts with us. Virginia served 9 years as an active duty U.S. Marine Corps officer, previously an instructor at the basic school in Quantico. Currently, she serves as senior defense policy analyst for the Center for Defense Information there at the Project on Government Oversight. Virginia, thanks for taking time for us.
Of course, Rick. Happy to be here.
So, did I miss something in the message? Did I... Because that's what I got. Fat, weak, woke, going to the streets. Shut up. Did I miss something?
No, I think you really hit the high points there. You know, you could get into the nitty-gritty of the details where, you know, Hegseth is outlining each one of the individual memos he's going to issue today. You know, I think I was losing track of the number of times he said, today, at my direction, right? And then rattling off sort of a list of grievance politics wrapped up in some kind of, you know, confused metaphor about his son joining the military in a few years. It was definitely disjointed, but it also wasn't anything new. You know, for something that was sort of touted as this big mystery event, we're going to fly in 800 senior leaders from across the globe in for it. At the end of the day, nothing he said was that much of a departure from things we've already heard, right? Like, yeah, sure, he codified some of it. And he said, hey, I'm going to release a memo, you know, and he says, you know, accused all of his leaders of, you know, the fat people in the hallways of the Pentagon. All right. But fundamentally, it's like, look, Pete, this is the same thing you've been saying for months now. Like, none of this is new. Yeah. Why did you have to waste millions of dollars and time and manpower to fly in all of these people to be your captive audience, right? Like, that's the real question here. This is quite literally the meeting that could have been an email. Yeah, just no, send them the memos.
And the rambling speeches. But here's the reality. They love spending money. I mean, back in June, you had Trump's big birthday bash parades, what, with $92 mm-hmm. million? Dollars. You had the National Guard that Trump called out to put orange vests on to pick up trash in the parks, somewhere around $200 million. And this, again, on the verge of a government shutdown.
Yep. So the interesting thing about this situation is these senior leaders are paying for their travel from their own units' lines of accounting, right? So when Pete sent out the message saying, come to me, leaders, and come listen to me talk, he's not sending them a check with that. He's not saying, by the way, here's, you know, $1,000 for the plane round trip plane ticket from, you know, Stuttgart or, you know, CENTCOM, or, you know, the poor admirals that are disembarking from their deployed carrier strike groups, right? He's not saying, here, it, you know, rides on me. This is actually taking money out of their units' spending accounts from what they were appropriated previously. So, in fact, not only is it costing money unnecessarily, it's taking away from, you know, probably training, equipment, and other things that the junior enlisted and like actual people in the military would need, right? It's the end of the fiscal year. Most units at this point have stopped spending because they're out of money and they're waiting on that, you know, fiscal appropriations from Congress to come through and actually give them the cash. And budget. So these men and women are flying in here on, you know, looking through the couch cushion for change to find something. And then there's actually a real reality that after the millions of dollars they scrounged up to get here, some of them may be stuck if they don't actually get a flight ticketed back home tonight before the shutdown, thus racking up even higher bills in hotel rooms here waiting to be able to go home.
Yeah, I'm kind of chuckling because, you know, this is not how you run a lemonade stand. But the reality is this is deadly serious stuff. And these are people who are in charge of the most lethal, most deadly fighting force in the history of humanity. And yet the message that the world got, and I got to wonder, you know, about the people who are stationed around the world and their safety in this moment, because that didn't look like strength to me. It looked like a lot of whining. It looked like a lot of grievance, especially out of our commander in chief. But it portrayed to me that this kind of weakness that I never really thought before.
Yeah, I mean, from the start, it was a huge national security risk. You want to talk about like assuming some kind of risk and putting people in danger. You know, those troops that are stationed abroad, their leaders were called away, right? If there was ever a time for China to invade Taiwan, it was this Tuesday, right? Like, hey, all the senior leaders in the Pacific are out of theater and they might be stuck in Washington for the next few days as the, you know, United States Congress tries to figure themselves out, right? So like there's that from the jump. We assume so much national security risk with this. And then, like you said, it's a lot of bluster. It's a lot of incoherent rambling, and it doesn't instill any kind of comfort that our leadership actually have a cohesive direction or understanding for how to use the military, right? It was a lot of politicization. It was definitely suggesting they're going to only further use the military domestically, right? Like Trump referenced that he wants to use our cities as training grounds for the military. That's hugely inappropriate. It's creeping towards authoritarianism, and it's concerning for every American who's, you know, wants good public safety and to make sure there aren't people wandering around their streets with military grade weapons.
Is it creeping or is it a full fledged sprint? I mean, because look,
I think you're, yeah, creeping is the, you know, generous, you know, it's a tepid term at this point, but I think you're right. We're moving there pretty quickly, especially with, you know, the recent shift to Portland and, you know, the list of cities that Trump gave today is, you know, possible places he wants to send the National Guard and other forces. Like, it's, yeah, it's here.
So let me ask you this, because, you know, as I kept hearing them talk about, you know, DEI and how weak we are and how woke the military is. You know, I got to ask you, you taking that personally?
Am I? I mean, when this administration first took over in January, I made the joke with a lot of people who look like me or maybe aren't white men in the military that we should all get, you know, T-shirts that said DEI hire on them and wear them for unit PT. We didn't. We felt that was probably not the best reaction, but you have to react to some of it with tongue in cheek just to survive in that world. If you're not, you know, the poster child for what Hegseth imagines when he thinks of the military, but no, it does hurt. It's like, hey, is my service less than someone who looks like Hegseth? Right? Like, that's definitely part of it. It doesn't not occur to me listening to those things. But at the end of the day, what I hear is a lot of whining and what I hear is a lot of focus, not on the important issues, right? Like, he can talk about, you know, oh, we're going to get rid of all of this unnecessary training. Ironic, since he called in all these generals to a training event that he mandated they go to, right? Like, that was hilarious in the moment. But at the end of the day, it's like, hey, where's the strength in this? You're whining about DEI and gender policies that fundamentally, like, that's not focused on warfighting. You keep talking about lethality. You keep talking about wanting to focus on warfighting. Where is that? None of that speech today talked about that. It was just more whining. It was more grievance politics. Yeah. And I heard nothing about, hey, how are you reforming appropriations? There was like maybe one sentence about that. Like, you wasted a lot of money in the Department of Defense. Where is it going? How are you going to make sure that that process is more efficient? How are you going to make sure that you are not just spending taxpayer dollars irresponsibly? I want to hear something about that. How are you ensuring that the warfighters you care so much about are getting safe and well-tested equipment, are, you know, living in barracks that are, you know, up to code and not going to give them, you know, diseases from black mold, making sure that military housing isn't ripping off America's military families, right? Let's talk about those things. You want to talk about people and personnel. Like, how are you taking care of them? I don't care about whatever perceived DEI issues you think you have, Mr. Secretary. Like, actually do something. Like you said, it's a lot of whining, it's a lot of bluster, and it's a lot of grievance politics.
I think we just saw why you're the problem. I think we did, yeah, because you actually, no, I mean, really, I mean, you seem to care about other people. This isn't about other people. This isn't about the soldiers. This isn't about the country. This is about one guy. And if any of that really came forth, it was Boeing wanting to name whatever jet they were going to name it 47 just to make Trump very happy. And I think John Stewart's right. Every time someone deals with Trump, it's like a Make-A-Wish kid getting his final wish. They come bearing gifts. And I was waiting to find out what the generals and all the people, you know, what kind of allegiance they were going to have to show, because this is, in my view, like you said at the beginning, this could have been done with an email, but to bring them together to kind of pressure them into applause or some kind of recognition, loyalty pledge, if you will. I kind of thought that's what this was really about. Do you have any thoughts?
Yeah, when the news first broke last week, I was definitely concerned, right? Like, part of me was like, is this going to be some kind of mass firing? Is this going to be some kind of purge? Right? Because we've seen that Hegseth and Trump are very willing to fire senior leaders with little to no justification, at least not public justification. And that's a bipartisan issue, right? I've watched the House Armed Services and Senate Armed Services committee hearings that Hegseth sits in front of, and Democrats and Republicans both go, hey, why are you firing so many generals? That's a national security risk. Like, we have concerns about that. And don't get me wrong, there is bloat in the general officer ranks, right? We have so many of them, and there definitely needs to be some oversight and some consideration to the scale of how many general officers we have. They cost a lot of money, right? But not this way. That needs to be done methodically. That needs to be done with appropriate review and oversight. And it also needs to be done with an eye to national security, right? Like, we can't forget that that is part of this equation. Instead, Hegseth has shown that he is so willing to just get rid of incredibly qualified senior officers. Like, Admiral Lisa Franchetti was the chief of naval operations, who he fired for what seems to be no other reason than she was a woman, a hugely respected naval officer. That woman was by far and away the top choice for CNO. She won it based on merit. Like he said today, we are going to promote and choose people for jobs based on nothing but merit. Admiral Franchetti was that choice when she took that seat, right? So, like, that's a huge part of it. And so I was very worried that today was going to be more of that there was potentially going to be him standing up there reading a list and saying, these people get out, right? I thought potentially a loyalty oath, right? And I don't think it was one explicitly, but what we can sort of surmise from this is, while they didn't have to raise their right hands and say, I love Donald Trump, it was still a performance of showing these generals and admirals and the world that when Trump and Hegseth say jump, they're supposed to say how high, right? Yeah. Hey, you come to us. We told you to come here and we're going to waste your time and there's nothing you can do about it. We don't care what you think. We don't care how tactically important it is that you remain in your seat, Pacific commanders, right? Or, you know, the ones in the Middle East. You have to come here. We don't care. Disembark from your aircraft carrier, Admiral. It's more important that you come here and listen to me blabber for 45 minutes. So it's showing them that. And it also communicated to them today that if they don't agree with the directions that Hegseth and Trump are taking, this Department of War, right, the DOD's preferred pronouns these days, then they can get out, right? Hegseth said that. He said, if you don't agree with me, you can get out, right? If you don't think this is the way the department should go, these aren't the standards we should hold, you guys can get out. Trump said the same thing. He walked in and made a joke. His first joke to the crowd was, oh, you're all very quiet. Clearly unnerved him that there was no positive feedback from the crowd. And then he said, you know, you can do whatever you want. You can laugh, you can cry, you can walk out. But if you walk out, there goes your rank. There goes your future. So yeah, it wasn't a loyalty oath, but it was still communicating to this crowd of the senior leaders of our military, hey, you're either with us or you're against us. And if you're against us, you're either going to get out of your own accord or we're going to fire you. And that's concerning because, going back to the issues we've already discussed of the military in the streets, who are the people in the best position to stand up to Trump and Hegseth about that? It's these senior leaders. It's these career professionals, most of whom have been in the military for over 30 years, who are more capable in military skills than Pete Hegseth has ever been or will ever be, who are more knowledgeable of strategy and national security than either of these gentlemen, and who are very familiar with the appropriate uses of the military and the constitutionality of the orders that they receive. And they are the ones who, when Hegseth says, hey, go into Portland, go into Chicago, patrol the streets, conduct local policing, violate the Insurrection Act, it's these senior leaders that are going to be the ones that say, hey, Mr. Secretary, that's not how this is done.
So let me ask you this. That's unconstitutional. Because you're absolutely right. These are the people who are going to have to kind of the last line of defense. If we're going to become a fully authoritarian state, given what happened to Mattis and Kelly and Milley and McMaster, and you go down the list, given what happened to them, do you think these people are up to doing? Because you just said their careers are on the line. There's a lot of bloat there.
I'm asking. Yeah, today was a scare tactic. Today was meant to threaten them and say, hey, do you value your career? Your entire 30 years of your career, are you going to risk it? Are you going to risk it all for the sake of, you know, impeding fascism? And I would like to hope so, right? I took the same oath when I served as every single one of those men and women in that room. When you're an officer, you take an oath to the Constitution, not the president. And I would like to think that the values and qualities that are instilled in every military officer will guide those men and women to make the right choice.
Yeah.
Again, everyone in the military is still an individual. And while they are apolitical as a professional body, everyone still has their own individual political views. I'm sure many in that audience voted for Donald Trump. I'm sure many of them, you know, are conservative in their personal politics. But I would hope that even with that, they will still sit there after today and say, you know what, this is not what I took my oath to.
Yeah.
This is not the appropriate use of our military. And I'm not going to put the men and women that serve under me in the position of having to make that choice instead of me.
Yeah,
right?
No, I think Hegseth hit on this. This is no longer an army of one army. You're in line. So I don't think they're allowed to have individual thoughts or any of that. And that whole Constitution thing,
very clear.
I'm expecting an executive order any day now. That loyalty is to the president. A president who...
The oath changes will be a dark day.
Absolutely, but it doesn't seem that we're surprised by all this, and this is where my shock is. I thought there would be much more response, and a lot of the people that I know who've served in the military, and again, I did not, but I got to assume that these folks near and dear to their heart, to see that, I got to question the responses today.
I think we're in a boiling the frog situation to some degree, right? Like everyone, you know, as I used the word earlier, I said, hey, creeping authoritarianism. And you were like, hey, maybe it's sprinting. And you're right. It is. But we are boiling this frog with the Trump administration, right? If you look at the issue of domestic deployment, right? And I'm not a lawyer, so I'm not going to, you know, pretend to be able to completely parse through all the legal issues surrounding it. But if you look at where they started, right, with L.A., they had very visual reasons to deploy the Marines and the National Guard there, right? Everyone saw the images of the protesters on, you know, the five and on the freeways in LA. And that was, you know, even if you agreed that, hey, the military shouldn't be there, you could see, oh, there seems to be some kind of visual thing that needs to be contained. Here are these protests, these masses of people that are disturbing life in LA, right? I do not think that the Marines and the National Guard should have been there, but like you could see someone justifying that, right? So they started with that. They started with that deployment, and they started with the National Guard and the Marines there protecting federal buildings, right? And then he says, well, DC is full of crime, and so I'm going to go to DC, right? And the president is the commander in chief of the DC National Guard, so he can do that. He has the authority to deploy them necessarily, right? So he says, oh, well, there's crime in DC. And so he starts doing that. And now they're starting to creep towards, oh, well, you know, we can send them to these other cities, right? And they find friendly governors in red states with blue cities, like, you know, Tennessee and Memphis, and say, hey, why don't you let us go in there? And if you look, there was a recent report, I believe it was the New York Times or the Washington Post, that said, hey, there's a potential authorization for use of military force legislation that's being rumored to be circulated through the White House and the Republican members of Congress that would be an AUMF authorizing force against drug cartels, which would potentially be justification for the extrajudicial killings that are currently ongoing in the Caribbean. And it would be very terrifyingly potential justification for them to go into any American city where they claim there is some level of drug cartel presence, right? And
because MS-13's everywhere,
believe them.
Yeah, MS-13's
MS-13, Trende Aragua. They could say, hey, there's a south safe house for Trende Aragua in, you know, the south side of Chicago. We need, you know, a battalion of Marines there tomorrow. And suddenly they have the authorization for use of military force that was passed by the Republican Congress, and they have the authority to send them. So like you said, it's boiling the frog. We started with that visual in LA that everyone could kind of go, oh, I can see it. I don't agree with it, but I can see why they sent them. And now they're just chipping away at it more and more and more, so that by the time the National Guard and the Marines and the Army are patrolling in the majority of the blue cities in America, it's not going to surprise anyone anymore. We've already gotten there. So that's why today no one's reacting super dramatically, because it's like, well, yeah, we anticipated this. The rhetoric is it's always just a small step. It's bad. It's terrifying if you look at it, sort of take a step back. But if you haven't really clued in lately, it's like, oh, it's the same.
So last question that I got for you, you know, Bob, when do we start to freak out? When is too far? Because anything that Trump's done in the, you know, the 12 years that he's been around would have sunk any other candidate, any other politician. When do we get to that? Oh, this is too far.
I think we're already there, right? Now, if you look at the, you know, not to tout my own organization too much, but POGO, the Project on Government Oversight, we have been sort of screaming from the, you know, church tower, like, hey, this is bad from the beginning, right? Like, as soon as the domestic deployment in LA started, like, we were putting out as much as we could and talking to members of Congress and saying, hey, this is something you need to act on, right? Like, 2 weeks ago, I submitted written testimony to the House Oversight Committee saying, hey, you need to step in and take action to actually exercise your oversight that you have as a congressional body and limit the president's ability to domestically deploy troops into American cities without any kind of accountability, right? Like, they need to take that action. They need to take that action months ago, but they haven't yet. And so, you know, people need to be calling their Congress members, especially if you have a Republican that represents you. Get into their offices, write to them, talk to them, say, hey, here are these issues, right? When in my testimony, I outlined like specific legislative steps that Congress can take to limit the president's emergency powers abilities, to limit the sort of gray areas around the Insurrection Act and posse comitatus that they could use to justify, you know, using the military for community policing, right? There are steps Congress can take. They're just, you know, wasting their time blustering as the government shuts down. And it's like, hey, why don't we actually step up and realize that this is bad for Americans? Take these steps. So like, I encourage everyone, you know, jump in, call your member of Congress, bug them, make their lives hard, because they have the most power to do something about this. There you go.
Virginia, I appreciate you taking time for us. I really would love to have you come back and walk us through more of this in the near future. Thanks so much.
Of course, Rick. Happy to be with you.
Virginia Berger, she is the Senior Defense Policy Analyst there at the Center for Defense Information at the Project on Government Oversight, pogo.org, the website, if you want to take a look at that. I want to hear your thoughts. When's going to be enough? When do you go, this is bad? I want to hear it. Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Right back. Stick around.
You're listening to 540 WAUK, Milwaukee's home for mornings with Pat Kreitlow.
The WAUK Text to Win contest, sponsored by Horizons Law Group, where they educate, collaborate, mediate, or litigate to serve you best. HorizonsLaw.com.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Partly cloudy and mild tonight, a low within a few degrees of 60. Mostly sunny and staying warm for tomorrow, a high in the mid-70s. We push into the 80s for the rest of the week and weekend, some rain chances towards Sunday. Currently at 62 degrees.
Matinee on air.
The borders are. Tom Homan was investigated for accepting $50,000 from undercover FBI agents.
50 grand in a fast food bag as a payoff. If Kamala Harris would have accepted a fast food bag full of fast food, it would have been congressional hearings, yes. 24 hours on every network that hated them.
It's corruption palooza, man. Yeah.
Matinee on air. Weekday mornings 9 to 11 on your local civic media radio station and on the app.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So interesting, as we're ticking down the hours, or who knows, could be closed by now, to the government shutdown, I got a text from one of my red friends, my red hat brigade, who said, you know, oh, what's this I hear? Democrats are going to shut down our government because they want health care for those illegals. And I'm going, how do you even begin to have a conversation with someone who's going to say something? And this is what I wrote back. How can I have a conversation with you when you say something so stupid? Because undocumented folks, they're not eligible for federally funded health benefits. It's not possible. But, you know, truth, reality, sanity, all that be damned. They've got a message, and they are sticking to it, and here to share some thoughts on that message and maybe how Democrats are going to play this. I've asked Bobby Kogan to come talk with us. Bobby's the Senior Director of Federal Budget Policy there at the Center for American Progress, AmericanProgress.org, the website if you want to check out their work. Bobby, thanks for taking time for us.
Rick, thanks so much for having me back on.
So let's start right there. Democrats going to shut the government down so we can give health care to illegals, Bobby. We're going to give the illegals everything they want.
So funny, right? Because that comes from Democrats saying, hey, we want to undo the Medicaid cuts. And somehow Republicans became convinced that, or they at least they told themselves that they weren't actually taking away Medicaid from any U.S. citizen ever. It was just 100% of illegals. $1 trillion of cuts that all came from undocumented immigrants, which is, of course, completely bogus and not true. But that's where that came from. Someone has just been drinking the Kool-Aid, hearing what, you know, the vice president has been lying again and again and again. And that's the message. But in truth, the answer is Democrats are asking for two things to keep the government open. They say we want to keep the government open, but the point of government is to help people, right? That's the point of government. In our annual appropriations negotiations, we secure housing for people, we secure education for people, we secure nutrition for people, right? The point of government is to help people. And they say, we absolutely want to keep the government open. We want two things to, you know, that we're asking for, since anything that makes it through is going to be bipartisan. So both sides are going to get some of what they wanted and not everything that they wanted. So the two things are, one, making sure more people aren't losing their health insurance, which is, you know, where that kind of lie comes from. And then number two, saying once we get to a deal, once we shake hands and, you know, once it becomes law, you actually have to follow it. And I think that second one. Yeah.
What? Once we shake hands, I have to actually honor my handshake. I have to honor my word. What?
Yeah. What a concept. So since his first day in office, President Trump has been illegally breaking budget deals, ones that have been signed into law, ones that have been signed into law by President Biden, and even ones that have been signed into law by President Trump himself.
Wow.
Right.
He's shocking.
Been saying, yeah, right. Totally. Right. He's been saying, that's cool, I'm just not going to follow it. And we obviously, famously, he's been doing this for life-saving foreign aid overseas, right? You know, billions and billions of dollars. The estimate is that, you know, so far, maybe 50,000 people have died from illegally withholding aid, and that over time it'll grow to be many millions of people. That cancer research, right? Education funding, like things that, you know, Americans are actually relying on, he's been illegally not spending. And so behind this all, you know, when you do a government funding negotiation, the whole point is to say, well, I'm going to supply my vote because you gave me this, right? I'm going to vote yes because I was able to secure this. But if the president can just turn around and then immediately ignore it, then he didn't actually secure anything. Government funding fights are all about policy. I'm not going to get everything that I wanted. You're sure. Not going to get everything of what you want.
It's like any negotiation. You get some of what you want, some of what you don't. And if everyone walks away from the table angry, you probably got a reasonable deal. But that's not what dictators want. Dictators want everything, and they want it now, and they want you to have nothing. So none of this is surprising to me that they, one, don't know how to negotiate, because they see that as a sign of weakness, that they can't impose their will on you. And two, to actually be tied to what they agreed to? Oh, that, my friend, bridge too far.
Yeah, so Trump's budget director, Russ Vogt, actually even openly said that he thought that there should be less bipartisanship, right? So that's like, that tells you kind of where they were on this. And so I said, you know, they'd been ignoring things they themselves had signed into law. That's a red line for them. That was one of the key asks that Democrats had been pushing forward, either like formally written into law, some ways to kind of go after that, or even handshake agreements. And in each and every single case, the Trump administration told, you know, signaled to Hill Republicans, don't take that deal. We don't want that. We are 100% desperate to continue doing this. It's something that they want to be doing. And in fact, in the middle of negotiations, like last month and the month before, they openly did and very publicly did even more of these impoundments where they are illegally not spending. So the whole point, you know, the whole point is this, and sorry, and just to be clear, it's not just me saying this. Right. It's also Republican members of Congress understand that there's an issue. So there are two senior appropriators, House Republican appropriators, Mike Smith and Mike Simpson and Steve Womack, both basically said, I don't know how you could agree to a deal if the White House is going to immediately back out of it. They're about policy, right? And Republicans, it's the way democracy works. They won the election. They won the presidency. They won the House. They won the Senate. The deal is going to be more in their favor than not. But it's still going to be a bipartisan deal. And it's going to be, you know, some things that they wanted, some things they didn't want.
Absolutely.
And what they want is the ability to say, no, actually, I altered the deal. You know, pray I don't alter it further, right? He literally wants to pull Darth Vader in like episode 5 and just get to do whatever he wants, whenever he wants. He want, you know, that's art of the deal to him, is to not have to stick to any deal.
No, art of the deal is which is more worthless, his word or his contract, his handshake or his signature. I don't know which is more worthless.
Yeah, totally. And so, like, you know, if even Republicans understand that it's really, really tough to negotiate if your deal that you thought you got is immediately changed unilaterally illegally, then, you know, that's why we are where we are. As I say, in the Democratic CR, they had a handful of provisions that are 100%, you know, intended to kind of go after this. And so it's not, you know, I really wouldn't even say like it's about shutting down the government over, you know, over these policy things. It's about making sure that once you are, you know, you can't actually credibly claim that you have funded these priorities if Republican or if the Trump administration can just take it away. You can't say I delivered healthcare if he can just not do the healthcare. You can't say I delivered housing if he can just not do the housing. You can't say I delivered food assistance if he can just not do the food assistance.
Yeah, you can. Because look, you know, I've been watching Trump speeches for a very long time. I don't know if you've noticed. You know, he's solving 3,000-year-old wars. He's, you know, making our military great again because he built it. And then something. There's so much word salad that comes out of his mouth. Self-aggrandizing, this kind of I'm the greatest without actual reality facts. Nothing. It's just a word salad. And he's good at it. I give him credit. And we have got a media that doesn't hold him accountable on any of it. And sadly, half of the voting populace doesn't either.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's true. It's very tough to get through to people who don't want to be educated. You know, talk about your friend who, you know, is only self-selecting among media that tells him everything that he wants to hear and won't hear it, you know, call it a lie if someone says, well, that's not actually true. You know, when we were going through the big, ugly bill and I was trying to tell folks about all the people who are going to lose their Medicaid, it was tough to reach the people who didn't want to be reached. They'd just say, no, that's not true. They're all illegal immigrants, right? That was what they'd say. And it's, of course, not true, right? They're just like, the numbers don't even work. There aren't even enough illegal immigrants to get the savings that they're going to get from, you know, that they say. And then they would say, well, those savings aren't true. And then you say, well, if the savings aren't true, then it's adding to the deficit. And they say, no, that's not true either. And then you're like, okay, well, if it's not kicking anyone off, and then it's not actually getting any savings. And then if it's not getting any savings, it's not doing deficit reduction. But, you know, they don't want to hear any of it.
See, the conversation that you're having is the conversation that I want to have with my redhead friends. But they're still stuck in this game of gotcha. And a lot of us, we go back and forth of, well, what do you think of this? I get this all the time from people. And I'm like, okay, I'll engage because I think there's an opportunity to go, okay, what you're talking about, giving undocumented people federally funded healthcare, is not a thing. And whoever told you that's lying to you. And now here's what reality is. So there's an education moment. And then to kind of walk it back where you're going. You know, if you're in the middle of a negotiation, if you're going to sit across the table from someone to buy a house or a car or, you know, whatever, does their word matter? Are you getting what they're telling you you're getting? And what do you get out of it? You know, the second that Democrats realized that Republicans needed their votes, that gave them some power to go, look, we want some stuff. And I got to tell you, I haven't seen Democrats ask for all that much. You said two things. I haven't seen all the things I want.
Yeah, that's right. You know, shutdowns are tough, right? Obviously, you're playing with fire there, right? The government provides for people. The whole point of government is to help people. Shutdowns that go on long enough break everything. That's why they never go on all that long.
Yeah, hold on. Let's flesh that second out for a second. Government is about helping people. I don't know that the people who are in charge of all of our branches of government, I don't know that they believe that.
I don't think they believe it either, but it is the point of government. Life is unfair. You don't get to pick if you're born healthy. You don't get to pick if you're you don't get to pick your parents. You don't get to pick if your parents are nice to you. You don't get to pick if your parents are healthy. You don't get to pick if you're born wealthy or poor. You don't really even get to pick how smart you are. You can pick how hard you try and how much you study, but you don't really get to pick your innate smarts or anything like that. There are lots and lots and lots of things about life that are just unfair, and there's nothing you can do about it. And the point of government is to help ameliorate some of that unfairness, right? Like, that's the point. It's the point of government is to help people. And what our government does is it lifts 30 million people out of poverty every year. 70% of what we do goes to people, right? That's like our Medicare, our Medicaid, our Social Security, our nutrition assistance, some of our education, our housing, right? Like, that is an amazing, amazing thing. And so obviously the six of government shutdown are huge. What the government does is it helps people. That is great. It should help a bunch more. There's a lot more they can do. It is woefully insufficient, but it is a force for good, right? Like, that's an amazing, amazing, amazing thing. That's why the stakes of shutdowns are really huge. And at the same time, it is really, really, really important that we make sure that the help we're trying to do actually goes out and actually delivers, right? Like, that's the thing. Otherwise, you haven't actually done anything.
Right. So, but here's the thing that gets me, and this is where, you know, I want to come back to this, because the politics of actually doing the work of We the People, because I'll be honest with you, I think most people have given up on the idea that government actually does help people, because it's been so broken for so long, and we've become so accustomed, especially working class voters have become so accustomed of not getting the things that they need from government. Now, our billionaire class, they get what they want and need. I don't know that working people feel the same. So this just seems like the, you know, the team sport thing. My red team, your blue team, and I want to shut down. I'm going to blame you for it. In the game that has become government shutdown, there, you know, the poll yesterday said that most people would say it was Republicans' fault because they control all the branches of government. And yet the messaging that I keep getting is it's all the Democrats' fault because they won't surrender. So how do you work through this? If you're, you know, if you're looking to actually do good.
Yeah. You have to have people who want to, you know, who want to get a deal. That you cannot make a deal with someone who doesn't want to make a deal with you. Obviously it's impossible. We've all experienced that at some point in our lives. Cooperation, you know, or they, what they say, it takes two to tango, right? It just, you can't force cooperation with someone who doesn't want to cooperate. And I think what's changed so much is that Republicans have decided that Dems will always cave and therefore they don't want to cooperate even an inch, right? So here's an example, you know, right here where they, you know, well, actually there are lots of quotes of them from March saying the same thing. They say Democrats will fold, and that's exactly what happened in March. And so they said the same thing this time. And what's different this time is Dems did not immediately fold. And that's why it looks like, you know, we're about to shut down. Or by the time this airs, we will have shut down. So, you know, that's the major change here, right? Where you say, okay, well, if you can't just push me around, if you want to actually come to a deal, you're going to have to sit down. How much do Republicans not want to come to a deal? Mike Johnson and the House of Representatives are literally not in town.
Yeah.
The budget director of the White House said there should be less bipartisanship. Donald Trump initially canceled his meeting with Hakeem Jeffries and Chuck Schumer. He finally did a meeting like the day before, but like, you know, that's how much they don't want to come to a deal. And what they're saying is, well, you should agree to what we're saying or we're going to shut down and it's your fault. And that's not how any negotiation works. If you want seven Democrats or more to sign on to what you're doing, you should probably ask the seven Democrats, well, like, what would it take? And if they propose something that you don't really like, then you could say, okay, well, what about this? What about this? What about this? But that takes someone who actually wants to negotiate. And the big issue is they don't want to negotiate, they want to control, right? And that's what you actually see with all the threatening. Donald Trump today said that he would do benefit cuts to people, right? And obviously they threatened to do mass firing of the civil service, which is, you know, harmful to themselves and their ability to carry out what they want to do, and obviously harmful to America when you lose kind of all that expertise in kind of carrying stuff out. It's a lot of very niche knowledge. And just to give an example, like, anyone listening, your company would never fire 100% of people and then just rehire them. You would never do that. If you're trying, like, you just never do that. You'd never get rid of the experts. You'd figure out who you wanted to get rid of, maybe selectively, but you wouldn't just do a mass firing.
Well, that's if you wanted to keep your company afloat. I still believe these people want to burn government to the ground so they can privatize and profitize the whole thing. And ultimately, I think that's kind of where we're at. We're dealing with arsonists who really do want to burn the government down. And Democrats who have been very reasonable in all this don't. I mean, maybe it's just my bias, but that's how I kind of see it, because if you really wanted to get a deal done, it's not, Democrats aren't asking for that much. And to your point about them caving, you know, Democrats have had kind of a history of being the ones that cave. I remember Dick Cheney, when he was vice president, going, you know, it's what they do. So this is kind of learned behavior on a certain level. And I guess good on them for finally in this moment stepping up.
Yeah. And that asymmetry creates bad, like, incentives, right? Like, if Republicans go in, if Republicans don't care about what, you know, the negative effects in a shutdown, and if Democrats do, and Republicans assume Democrats are therefore going to cave because they're the ones that care, you know, and not them, then obviously that creates an incentive to just hold out. And then it becomes a self-fulfilling cycle, right? Like, that's a very problematic thing. And like, that's why, you know, like, you know, I hate the people who talk about game theory, but it's a simple game theory thing, right? It's this fundamental deterrence. It's why anytime Israel hits Iran, Iran hits back, and it's like, okay, do we want to be clear? We're not starting a war, but we are hitting you back. And it's because they want them to know that anytime you send a missile over there, they're going to send a missile back, so that there is just at least some part of the back of their mind knowing if we do this, there will be a response. And it's the same thing here, right? When Obama, like Republicans forced Obama, well, I don't want to say forced, Republicans threatened Obama on the debt limit. And he did a massive, massive capitulation in 2011. And it was awful. And he said, I am never doing that again. Don't you dare test me. And in 2013, Republicans were like, we're going to do it again. And he said, don't you dare do it. I will walk you over the edge. And he was convincing. And so Republicans said, okay, well, we talked a big game, so we need a fake thing that we can claim victory. And he said, fine, I'll give you a fake thing. And then in 2015, he said, I'm not even giving you a fake thing this time. Don't you dare. Don't test me. I'll do it. And like, that was a learned behavior. That, you know, in 2011, he was afraid of shutdowns. In 2011, he was afraid of Republicans walking him over the edge in terms of defaulting as well. And he said, I'm never doing that again.
Yeah. No, and this is how you deal with children. And sadly, we have children running our government. And I don't know how we're going to get out of this. The last question I've got for you, any predictions on how long this takes? Do they come up with a 11th hour deal for a couple of days and keep doing that? Or do you got any, we're on the cusp. Any ideas?
I don't think we'll have an 11th hour deal. I'd be very surprised. Shutdowns typically end when enough things are about to break. Shutdowns start off bad and then eventually they get cataclysmic, right? So just to put into words, like when I say it would be cataclysmic, if a shutdown went long enough, Medicaid would stop, SSI would stop, food stamps would stop, WIC would stop, TANF would stop, right? Childcare would stop, right? A whole bunch of things that people take for granted would all stop. That's eventually, you know, our airports would stop because all TSA would be quitting and everything, right? So eventually the whole society falls apart. That's why shutdowns never go on that long, because you stop them before they get that long. So shutdowns always end right before things get bad enough. And every single time it's different, because the timing of how much money there is in the bank that you can kind of go on for all these programs is different every single time. Right. So one of the things that could cause us to break is WIC, which gives money to poor newborns and pregnant women, has only about a week in it. And it's not clear what happens after that week. And so you might see a deal around a week. Or maybe we go over that deadline and then we get to the next one where you say, okay, well, this one's about to break and we won't let this one break. Oh, okay, well, this one's about to break. So that's like, that's what I'm going to be looking for in the next few days. We'll start to see a whole bunch of reports of various things that only have some numbers of days. And that's where I think we'll start to see this thing end.
All right. Well, Bobby, I appreciate the time. Appreciate the thoughts. We'll see how this plays out.
Thanks for having me on, Rick.
Thanks so much, Bobby Kogan, Senior Director of Budget Policy there at the Center for American Progress. Make sure you check out their website, AmericanProgress.org. Want to hear your thoughts. Do you agree with me, as I've been saying? You know, the solutions to our problems are going to come out of the suffering due to their savagery. As they break things, it's going to hurt. I want to hear it. Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1851. That was the day that William Henry, a black cooper or barrel maker who went by the name of Jerry, was arrested in Syracuse, New York. He was first told that he was being arrested for theft, but then he learned that federal marshals had arrested him for violating the Fugitive Slave Act passed the year before. Jerry had escaped slavery in Missouri. The Anti-Slavery Liberty Party was holding its convention in a nearby church. When word came about Jerry's arrest, a crowd rushed to release him. Once released, he was quickly recaptured and returned to custody. But then a large crowd, numbering more than 2,000, gathered to free Jerry from the office where he was being held. According to research done by the Syracuse University Library, the first person into the office was J.M. Clapp, an iron worker likely chosen for his brawn. The crowd was able to free Jerry and hide him until he could escape into Canada. Clapp also had to flee to Canada to avoid arrest along with 8 others. 19 people were indicted for participating in the rescue. Only one person was ever convicted, and he died before he could appeal. In turn, the abolitionists won an indictment against the marshal who had arrested Jerry. They charged him with kidnapping. Although the marshal was acquitted, it gave the abolitionists a chance to publicly challenge the constitutionality of the Fugitive Slave Act. Each year until 1858, a Jerry Rescue celebration commemorated the event. Abolitionists referred to the, quote, Jerry level as a standard for justice. In 2001, a monument to the rescue was dedicated in Clinton Square in downtown Syracuse. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and the Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
You're listening to the Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
You know, I gotta tell you, it's great to hear someone who actually gets the idea that government is about making people's lives better. That's the point. The point of doing all this, the point of going through all of this, is to actually do the work of we the people. And it begs the question, why do these people who are our quote-unquote political leaders, why do they get into this? Why do these people run for office? You know, it's one of those questions I ask people when they're running for things. You know, why are you putting yourself into this? What about this are you trying to improve, to make better? What are you trying to do? And what I find interesting about the divide between the red and the blue is on the red side, it's about restraint. We've got to restrain government's actions to help people. We've got to cut, slash, and burn, which is why it was interesting that I got an email from someone going, you know, this could be the best government shutdown ever. And the justification was, we're going to slash and burn government down to where it's small enough to drag into the bathtub and drown it. Understand, Republicans have been telling us this for years, that this is what they believe. They believe they want weak, ineffective government. For you, for their donors, for the billionaire class in this country, well, we need to keep the rabble in check, which is why we're evidently now, and you know, as we talked about earlier, evidently now we're going to be turning the military, which I just found out was fat, weak, and woke. Oh, we're going to turn them into lean, mean fighting machines by going into our cities. Yeah, they're going to practice on Americans. Anybody else got a problem with that? Anybody else got a problem with that speech we saw? And the fact that the military high command had to sit there and listen to that, to be lectured by someone like Pete Hegseth, and then to have Donald Trump go on whatever that, I go back to it, that rambling who knows what. All about grievance, all about how wonderful he is, and you know, the whole thing about the Nobel Prize, and my goodness, it was bad. And the rest of the world watched. The rest of the world saw the commander-in-chief of the most powerful fighting force in the history of humanity dress down the military. It's quite remarkable when you stop and think about it. It's quite remarkable that I haven't heard any Republican voices going, maybe not do that on national TV. If you're going to do that to the generals, if you're going to go after them, maybe you do that stuff behind closed doors. But to do it in front of the entire world shows just how little these people understand their jobs. And as I asked Bobby Kogan a moment ago, I don't know which is more worthless, Donald Trump's word, his signature, or a contract with his signature on it. Because it's interesting that we're in this position.
It's interesting that we're in the position of this. Want to hear your thoughts. Is this what you wanted? Is this winning? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I need to hear. By all means, if you miss any portion of the program, download the podcast. And as always, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Rick@thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
This is 540 WAUK Jackson, Milwaukee's real news and great conversation. A Civic Media station.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by Progressive Insurance.
I'm Peter King. The first day of the government shutdown is in the books with no movement toward a compromise that would end it. Republicans blame Democrats and vice versa. President Trump has promised massive layoffs of government workers. House Democratic leader Hakeem Jeffries.
Everything that the Trump administration has said about the government shutting down confirms the fact that Republicans are delighted to have shut down the government.
Here's CBS's Stacey Lynn.
White House Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt says layoffs are imminent.
They are, unfortunately, a consequence of this government shutdown.
And sources tell CBS News that the OMD director says those layoffs will begin within 2 days.
The Office of Management and Budget is working with agencies across the board to identify where cuts can be made.
Vice President Vance says it's not what they want to do.
But we're going to do what we have to keep the American people's essential services.